What is it exactly that we seek when we seek love? A witness, a refuge, or a home? Or perhaps someone who will stay long enough to make us feel less alone inside ourselves? We speak so often of love as destiny, chemistry, luck. But perhaps love is also memory, biology, fear, hope. A thousand invisible emotional threads woven long before we ever meet the people we call ours. Why do some people crave closeness while others run from it? Why do couples who once couldn't keep their hands off each other suddenly find themselves sharing silence instead of desire? Why do some remain deeply committed to one person while others search for connection in more than one place, more than one body, more than one emotional universe? And beneath all these questions, another quieter one waits. Are we becoming freer in love or simply more afraid? Hello, wherever you're listening from around the world, from the studios of The Voice of Greece, this is Infinitely Curious. I'm Katerina Badzaiki, on sound Nick Savorginakis, and today we explore one of the most fascinating and vulnerable subjects of our lives. Attachment, intimacy, desire, jealousy, loneliness, and the fragile architecture of human connection. Because perhaps the greatest mystery is not why relationships fail, but why, despite disappointment, grief, heartbreak, and confusion, we continue trying to love. We often speak of love as though it simply happens. As though one day someone arrives, something sparks, and everything falls magically into place. But psychologists have spent decades asking a more complicated question. Why do we love the way we love? Why do some people feel safe in intimacy while others become anxious, distant, or overwhelmed? The answer may begin very early, before romance, before memory, before language itself. In the 1950s, British psychiatrist John Bowlby introduced what became known as attachment theory. His radical idea was simple. The emotional bonds we form in childhood shape how we experience closeness throughout life. Security, fear, trust, abandonment. The ways we learned or failed to learn to regulate our emotions. These patterns, he argued, quietly follow us into adulthood, into friendships, into marriage, into desire, and into heartbreak. Our first guest voice today is therapist and relationship expert Anne Power, who describes attachment theory as something profound, the science of love. She explains why human behavior makes sense in context, why emotional safety allows curiosity to grow, and why learning to regulate feelings can transform relationships. Here is Anne Power.
The story I'm bringing you today is about an idea. It emerged in this city, London, 100 years ago. It's been refined by thousands of research studies, and today it's buzzing on social media platforms around the world. What's this idea that goes on spreading? It's about love. You may say, there are no new ideas about love. And I would say, this isn't romance, it's science. Attachment theory sees love as part of our evolutionary design. And the term attachment describes a particular kind of close bond between two people. The kind of connection that when they're together, they feel safe. And when they're apart, they may feel loss. I believe an understanding of attachment theory can make a profound difference to the way we love and to the way we allow others to love us. I hold this conviction from two sources: 25 years as a therapist helping people repair their early attachments, and 65 years as an individual making sense of my own attachment story. Today, I would like to give you three takeaways about attachment, but first, let's begin that story into the origins of the theory. Let me take you to the 1930s, to North London, to an elite professional group, the Institute of Psychoanalysis. There's a new member in the group, John Bowlby, but he's not fitting in. His mind is too scientific to win friends here, yet within a few decades, his ideas will be known and studied in universities around the world. And in the 21st century, they're popping up in our news feeds, influencing how we raise our children and work on our relationships. Bowlby believed all behavior makes sense in context. It's a belief that can inspire curiosity and respect for our own behavior and for the behavior of those around us. And it inspired Bowlby to make sense of the parent-child bond. We're looking at an image from a 1930s experiment where a baby monkey has been taken from his real mother and placed in a cage. There are two options in the cage: a wire mother who can provide milk, and a cloth mother who has no milk, but whose softness provides a crumb of comfort. The experiment showed that the monkeys chose the cloth mother every time, and they only reach for the wire mother when they really need to feed. Bowlby studied these experiments, and he noticed that young creatures attach to their caregiver. They attach to the one who provides safety and comfort. And he stressed that this attachment to a supportive other is not just for babies. We all need someone to whom we can turn, whose presence soothes us when we're troubled. Bowlby saw evolution at work. This bonding behavior is so deeply embedded in us because it supports survival of the species. His team noticed that human infants, like the baby monkeys, adapt their behavior to get the best care in their given situation. So let's imagine two different homes and see how the babies there are coping. If my mum only rouses from her depression. When I make her hue and cry, then that's what I'll learn to do. In the next door house, the baby is an equally quick learner, but his mum has a different character. She's not comfortable with feelings. So this little boy will adopt a different strategy. To get the best care from his mum, he'll learn to keep his feelings under wraps. Attachment researchers would say that the first child who amplifies feelings is developing an anxious attachment strategy, and the second child who minimizes is more avoidant. Now, at this point, those of you who are parents might be thinking, what hope for us, we're doing our best. And perhaps just as adults, you might be thinking, what if our own parents had emotional struggles when we were young? But I don't want to give you the feeling that these two children are going to have terrible lives. They're not. They're normal kids, and many of us are a bit like one of these. But if they're going to have fulfilling relationships, then they will need to unlearn some of that early training. But now back to our story. We've reached the 1950s, and attachment theory is coming into conflict with the establishment. You may not know that hospitals did not always allow parents to stay alongside their children on the wards. In the austere regime of 50s Britain, visiting was kept to 1 hour a week on a Sunday. Staff were so convinced of the rightness of this, they allowed one of Bowlby's collaborators to film a two-year-old as she was admitted to hospital. Picture her, alone, with no parent by her side. The subsequent black and white footage was so poignant, it allowed campaigners to achieve a complete change in the rules. But the campaign was still a struggle, because we find change difficult and we find it hardest when we feel insecure. And that leads to the next slide. Safety enables learning. When we feel secure and confident, we're free to learn and explore. When we feel threatened, learning goes out the window. Let's imagine a young girl in the park playing and exploring like the two boys. A huge dog comes along and scares her. What happens next? She runs for her parents. Fear has switched on her primitive brain. And in attachment terms, this secure child is seeking her parents because the closeness with her parents will literally change her body chemistry. And then she can return to her games. And these pathways between anxiety and reassurance exist in us as adults too. If we trust our attachment person, the soothing can be quite easy, a touch, a text, a look. And when we feel safe again, our brains can return to full functioning. Now we've come to the current chapter in our story. And this chapter, I think if it was in a textbook, it might be entitled The Application of Attachment Theory to the Adult Couple Bond. So I don't know if there's any couples here, whether that you identify with that title, but let's see what's happening now in the world of attachment. John Bowlby always stressed that attachment was a need from cradle to grave. But his own focus was more on that parent-infant bond. Researchers who came after him studied the adult-adult bond, and they found the same key markers of attachment, which means that two people seek closeness when they need protection, and they protest when they're separated, whether that's the small separation that might happen in a disagreement or the ultimate separation of death. And just as with children, if the bond is secure, a secure bond in adults provides two key functions, a place of safety and a platform for growth, because safety enables learning. You remember the two groups who struggled to manage their feelings? The avoidant group who need to keep things under wraps, and the anxious group who want it out on the table. What happens if you put those two into a couple together? Some of you might know the answer to that. But another psychologist, Susan Johnson, has studied this in detail. And she's noticed how these two characters trigger each other. And in fact, they get into a very unhappy dance, a kind of loop where they're stuck. By describing the more anxious partner as a pursuer and the more avoidant as a withdrawer, she has created a new map. And the map shows us what's been hidden. And the thing that's been hidden behind the embittered exchanges are the precious, vulnerable feelings that connect two people. Once couples can read their own map, they can see that their partner's behavior makes sense in context. And when the blaming stops, learning can begin, because safety enables learning. And by the way, this is equally good news for single people, because coming to terms with our attachment patterns is a great preparation for all close relationships. And for those of us who are parents, whether our children are still young or fully grown, this understanding can deepen connection. And if repair is needed, it can help with that too. But most of us know that it's one thing to understand a pattern and another thing to shift it. And that takes us to our final takeaway. Slow down for the bump. Slow down for safety and learning. Some of the biggest bumps and triggers we meet in our lives come from our own attachment losses and longings. It could be bereavement, betrayal, rejection. Some of the most common triggers come from within us. It could be a mean, self-critical voice that puts us down. How can we help ourselves weather these bumps when our attachment person is not available? Learning to pay mindful attention to the self is a great help with difficult feelings. When we're triggered, our breathing and heart rate speed up. That's the adrenaline. If we can learn to slow those down, we create a window where we can look with curiosity and respect on our troubled feelings. And that will give us a chance to interrupt the fight-flight mechanism before it sends us into attack or retreat. So that's our final takeaway. But let's recap on the three with the last slide. All behavior makes sense in context. Safety enables learning. And slowing down can create that safety. So let's learn to use a slow out-breath to soothe our heart rate. As our reactions soften, our curiosity can grow. Curiosity brings openness to the other. Openness brings vulnerability. And vulnerability is the heartbeat of all intimate relationships. And this is why attachment theory is the science of love.
All behavior makes sense in context. Perhaps that sentence alone could save many relationships. Because how often do we misunderstand each other? How often do we call someone cold when they are frightened, clingy when they are terrified of abandonment, distant when they simply never learned how safety feels? Attachment theory does not excuse hurtful behavior. But it invites compassion, and perhaps compassion is difficult precisely because intimacy demands something frightening. To be seen. Completely, not the edited version, not the confident version, but the anxious, insecure, imperfect self beneath. And yet, something curious happens in long relationships. Even when safety exists, even when affection remains, desire, sometimes disappears. Why? Why do so many couples still love each other but stop touching, stop longing, stop reaching? Why do some relationships slowly become emotional partnerships rather than romantic ones? And when physical intimacy fades, what quietly enters the room instead? Loneliness, resentment, fantasy, silence, or betrayal? Before our next conversation, a song that feels like emotional gravity itself. Something about needing closeness and fearing loss at the same time. Love, marriage, companionship, sex, we tend to imagine they naturally belong together. But reality is often messier. Many couples deeply care for one another and yet stop having sex entirely. Some quietly live as companions, some suffer in silence, some feel ashamed to even speak about it. Others search elsewhere for intimacy or retreat into loneliness. Research increasingly suggests that sexless marriages are more common than many imagine. But the bigger question is not simply why sex disappears. The real question may be, what happens emotionally when desire leaves the room? Does intimacy deepen? Or does distance slowly begin growing between two people who once felt inseparable? In this next extract, nurse, sex educator, and radio host Maureen McGrath speaks openly about sexless relationships, loneliness, infidelity, and emotional disconnection. And perhaps most importantly, whether intimacy can ever truly be rebuilt. Here is Maureen McGrath.
Only about 7% of married couples set the sheets ablaze. Most married couples have sex a little bit more than once a week for the first decade of their marriage. It decreases after that. So they have sex about 58 times a year. And 20% of marriages meet the criteria as a sexless marriage. And that, defined by the experts, is sex less than 10 times a year. So why aren't we having sex in our marriages? Well, there's a little known chemical in the brain, conveniently called PEA, or P, and it's responsible for the elation, the excitement, and the euphoria that you feel when you meet somebody that you are sexually interested in. It's a fantastic feeling. This chemical is scourging through your blood vessels. You are so happy. That's how powerful this little chemical is. Well, what happens after 2 years, that chemical diminishes, as does sexual frequency. That's just about the time you might get married or may have conflict in your relationship. And that is why communication is key to great sex. Now, there's another reason we're not having sex in our relationship, and that has to do with the sex education that we provide. I'd like to share a story about myself. When I was a teenager, my mother came racing into my bedroom, and she said, "Maureen, please tell me you have not allowed a boy to French kiss you." She was feeling terrible that this sex education came a bit late, and I was feeling horrifically guilty as an Irish Catholic girl that I'd French kissed a number of boys by that stage. We teach girls and women that sex is dirty and sex is bad or it's overrated. We say you're just going to get a sexually transmitted infection anyway, or you might get pregnant. This whole fear-based thing frightens women from enjoying sex. And we never talk about pleasure with girls and women or orgasm. And in fact, some women say orgasm's not important and that the journey is just as good as the destination. I disagree. Of course. I'm the one who French kissed all the boys as an Irish Catholic girl. It's like getting on a train with your lover and you are going to the most pleasurable place on the planet. You are so excited. You're getting lubed up with all the free drinks they're giving you. This is amazing. And just before you reach your destination, he gets off and you don't. You get my point. Now, the sex education we have for boys and men, that's entirely different. It's a global program. It's free. It's accessible to everybody. And it's known as internet pornography. Fantastic. And it does nothing to teach men and boys about intimacy, which is really important to men and boys, or how to make love to anybody. Also, we have a paucity of information about sexual health for our LGBTQI community. And we need to add to that. Now, marriage can rapidly go from holy matrimony to holy hell with the finances, the kids, the houses, the illness. I mean, you may have signed up for sickness and health, but that was long before you'd ever witnessed a man cold. And how about that richer or poorer thing? Ladies, we're going to have to start going for richer. Most women today are working inside and outside of the home. We're doing the lion's share of the housework because, according to research, men don't feel they're that good at it. And we're bridging the gap between growing children and aging parents. We are exhausted doing it all and never doing it. And when we are doing it, we're checking our smartphones. 10% of people check their smartphones during sex. 35% immediately afterward. We are connected to the internet. We are connected to the internet and disconnected from our would-be lovers. Maybe this is the reason that the most common sex position for married couples is doggy style. No. It's not what you're thinking. Get your minds out of the gutter. This is the one where he's on all fours and begs, and she plays dead. I have a clinical practice where I see patients that have sexual dysfunction. And there are two questions that I ask everybody. And the first one is, are you sexually active? It's obvious. And when I ask women, they never say yes or no. Well, they never say yes, but they never say yes or no. They say, sometimes, sort of, I'm not sure. He is. Or they say, I'm married. I say, well, that means no to me. They say, yes, you're right, it is no. Most men complain that women never initiate sex. The reason for this is because, once again, the sex education we provide to women. Women falsely believe that female sexual interest, desire, precedes sexual activity, when in actuality, it is sexual activity that prompts sexual interest and desire. Sexual arousal emerges as a result of sexual activity. So, you guys, I know, intimacy is important to you. And the most important question that reflects this that I received from you is, how much masturbation is too much masturbation? So, I just say, well, as long as you can go to work, you should be fine. And then I realize that that's perhaps all that you're doing at work. So, I know intimacy is important. You want to come home and you want to make love to your wife if you're in a heterosexual relationship. So after a long and quite possibly very hard day, you come home to a bit of chaos perhaps, but you've just got sex on the mind, and she says, did you remember the milk? And you're like, darn, the milk. I forgot the milk. Don't beat yourselves up about it. If not for the milk, we have Facebook, hormones, I'm feeling a little tired tonight, my stomach's sticking out, I'm feeling kind of fat, can't do it tonight. Didn't we have sex last month? And you're like, that was actually last year. You don't get it. I mean, literally, you don't get it. But you're like, she's amazing. She's works in and outside of the home. She does a great job with the kids. She volunteers. She even has time for girls' nights out. Their parents were pressuring them to have children because they wanted grandchildren. When they came into my clinical practice, the second question that I ask everybody that enters my clinical practice, most unfortunately, is, have you ever experienced sexual abuse or unwanted sexual advances as a child? This was the first time this gentle man had learned that his wife had experienced sexual abuse as a six-year-old at the hands of her best friend's father. She thought sex was dirty. She hated sex. We need a worldwide moratorium on ending sexual violence on our children, boys and girls, because it happens to both. Healing from sexual abuse takes a lifetime. Ella had lived a lifetime. A widow, she said she wasn't sexually active, but she hoped to be. I thought, fantastic, somebody is going to have sex here. But she said, the problem, Maureen, is that these old guys can't get it up anymore. I said, well, Ella, you might have to go for a younger guy. She said, what's younger when you're 84? 70? Yes, some of you are saying. The hard truth is that men in their 30s and 40s may experience erectile dysfunction. George presented to my clinical practice. At age 40, he decided to settle down.
He was marrying a beautiful and accomplished woman in a few months. There's only one problem.
George was gay. George could not bear to tell his family that he was gay because he felt it would have shamed the entire family. I said, George, you're going to end up in a sexless marriage. He said, tell me something I don't know. So George said to me, his plan was this. Well, when my parents die, I'm then going to divorce this woman, and I'm going to marry the man that I love. And I said, George, you are not thinking straight. Sex is the barometer of the state of affairs in a marriage. People who live in sexless marriages report feeling frustrated, unloved, undesirable, unattractive, and the worst of all, lonely. And loneliness has been shown to increase vascular resistance and elevate blood pressure and lead to an early death. You are more likely to die from loneliness than you are from obesity or excessive alcohol consumption. When I educate women and I say, if you're not having sex with your husband, someone else may, they get upset and they say that I'm blaming women for men's bad behavior. When in actuality, I'm doing a community service. You see, men in sexless marriages cheat to remain in that marriage in general. And women cheat to leave a sexless marriage. And women cheat too. Nobody ever thinks we do. We're just sneakier about it. We just don't get caught. Historically, marriage was not based on mutual love, but rather it was an institution to acquire, of all things, in-laws, property, and physical labor. But at the turn of the 20th century in America, egalitarian ideals and the emerging Hollywood movie industry burdened marriages with promising romantic love forever. And now we're living forever. Fantastic. Congratulations. You get to have sex with the same person for the rest of your life. The second most common question that I hear from patients is, when does sex end? Well, a 44-year-old asked me, he said, when does sex end, Maureen? 65? I answered him this way. A 22-year-old asked me, when does sex end, Maureen? 35? Everybody's older until you get there. I'm here to tell you that sex never ends. If you're healthy, you can have a... If you're healthy, you can have a great sex life well into your 80s and 90s. Sex is good for you. Sex is healthy, yet sex is shrouded in shame. In the ancient aristocracies, the wealthy men had courtesans for pleasure and concubines for quick sex. In the way we're going, computers will be our concubines. Internet pornography, our mistress of the day. Technology is fast replacing human connection at high speed. So how do you rev up the sexless marriage? Sex is about blood flow. Sexercise. Every day, you want to have a daily workout. It increases your agility, your stamina. Women will experience more sexual sensation when blood is flowing to the genitalia. It also helps to treat erectile dysfunction. Also, get help for any of the sexual dysfunctions you may have. Vaginal dryness, it's an issue that happens to women who are on the oral contraceptive pill, who are breastfeeding, perimenopausal, postmenopausal, and there are treatments for you. Pay more attention to your spouse than you do your smartphone. Spend more time in your bedrooms than you do your boardrooms, or your bedrooms are going to become boardrooms. Deal with your marital issues. Go to sleep in the same bed at the same time, and don't bring anything or anyone into your marriage except for a great sex toy and a darn good sex therapist. You must establish guidelines that govern those moments when you are struck by someone's attractiveness outside of your marriage. But don't think for a second that you have to have sex with the same person for the rest of your life. That's not what I mean. In your mind, that is. Fantasy is key. Your brain is your largest sex organ. And one more thing, I would like to leave you all off with a bang. Settle all marital arguments in the bedroom, naked.
What struck me listening to that is how little we speak honestly about loneliness inside relationships. Because loneliness when you're alone is one thing, but loneliness beside someone you love, that may be one of the deepest forms of grief. Sometimes relationships survive because people are afraid to leave. Sometimes they end because people stop trying. And sometimes people remain faithful emotionally while drifting physically. Other times, the opposite happens. And perhaps this is where uncomfortable questions emerge. What if monogamy, at least for some people, is not effortless? What if jealousy is more complicated than possession? What if the longing for connection sometimes exceeds what one relationship can contain? But then another question arrives. Are we expanding our emotional capacity or avoiding vulnerability? Because intimacy, real intimacy, eventually asks difficult things from us. Patience, repair, honesty, discomfort, the courage to remain, or perhaps the courage to leave. Before we continue, a song that feels like standing in the fragile space between closeness and distance. Jealousy. Few emotions reveal us more quickly. We often treat jealousy as weakness, something irrational, possessive, embarrassing. But what if jealousy is also information? A mirror, a signal pointing toward fear, fear of abandonment, fear of not being enough, fear that love is temporary. But there is another idea, one many people have never heard, a word unfamiliar to most of us. Compersion, the opposite of jealousy, the idea that one might feel joy for another person's joy, even when it stretches our emotional comfort. Is that possible, or does it simply sound beautiful in theory? Psychologist and sex educator Jolie Hamilton invites us into this complicated emotional territory. not to erase jealousy, but to understand it, and perhaps through understanding, to grow. Here is Jolly Hamilton.
When I tell people that my work involves polyamory, the practice of having multiple intimate relationships in a loving and communicative and consensual way, their reaction is usually something like, wow, okay, well, sure, but I could never do anything like that. I would be way too jealous. But I've been researching relationships for a long time now, and I haven't found any kind, including monogamy, that completely protects us from feeling jealous, because jealousy is normal. Psychologists can spot it as soon as 6 months old, and it only gets more complicated from there. Here's a quick primer on jealousy's complexity. See, it doesn't travel alone. Jealousy is made of primal emotions like anger, sadness, shame, and fear. Jealousy can't be separated from fear. It cracks us open because it taps into our primal terror that we will be abandoned, that we'll lose our loved one to a rival. But jealousy is so powerful, it doesn't actually need a real rival to drive us to distraction. If no real rival exists, it can attack through the imagination. In that way, it's similar to anxiety. There doesn't need to be a real threat for any of us to feel anxious. Jealousy can invent a rival and create this triangle in us, and triangles can be trouble. So, who are these polyamorous people? Well, I study polyamory as both a researcher and a polyamorous person myself. A recent study suggested that 5% of the U.S. population is currently practicing some form of ethical, consensual non-monogamy right now, and 20% have tried it at some point. That's the same percentage of people who play musical instruments. But polyamorous people invite jealousy right in through the front door. If jealousy feels so awful, then why the heck would they do that? Well, the very first thing my research turned up was simply that they have found that this relationship structure, it has more positives than negatives for them. More often, the sticky feelings of jealousy catch us. And when they do, we have the chance, we can stop and see that jealousy is just one of many things we're feeling. And when we notice all those choices, well, that gives us agency. When a partner or a friend is enjoying time without us, we can give ourselves a break, offer ourselves some compassion for the very real suffering we're feeling, and then we can remind ourselves that we value a balance of autonomy and interdependence in our relationships. We can make a little space for compersion next to the jealousy we're feeling. Jealousy, it's inescapable in all of our lives. It'll show up in our romances, our friendships, our workplaces, our families. Right when we're feeling secure, a tidal wave of jealousy can sweep us off our feet. And in that moment, we have the opportunity to see, courageously see, the multitude of feelings that we can contain all at once. Compersion offers us a different path, one that aims toward deep intimacy. Compersion's a courageous choice. We don't need to be perfectly compersive. We don't need or even want to be jealousy free, because jealousy is normal. We can just stay with the process. Dancing with compersion and jealousy is part of being on an adventure of intimacy, an adventure that teaches us something new about ourselves every day. Perfection not required.
I find something deeply human in what we just heard, because perhaps maturity in relationships is not the absence of jealousy. Perhaps maturity is curiosity about jealousy. What exactly is hurting? What fear has awakened? What story are we telling ourselves? And perhaps the greater question is this: can love survive freedom, or does freedom eventually threaten love? Because for many people, love means exclusivity, safety, commitment, choosing one person again and again. Yet for others, love looks different, not less sincere, not necessarily less ethical, but structured differently. Which brings us to one of the most debated relationship models of our time, polyamory. For some, the idea sounds impossible. For others, deeply liberating. Polyamory, the experience of having multiple consensual romantic relationships at once, raises difficult questions. Can one person realistically meet all emotional needs? Can honesty replace secrecy? Can emotional literacy reduce jealousy? Or does the difficulty of staying deeply connected to one person sometimes push us towards alternatives? In a culture increasingly shaped by speed, independence, and endless options, are we learning emotional flexibility or forgetting how to endure emotional difficulty? These are not simple questions, and perhaps there are no universal answers. In this next extract, Kel Walters discusses polyamory through the lens of emotional literacy, communication, and consent. Listen closely, not necessarily for agreement, but for understanding. Here is Kel Walters.
Now, your first logical question is, what is polyamory? Well, let's look at the word and break it down to its roots. You've got poly and amory. Poly from the Greek meaning many, and amory from the Latin meaning loves. So many loves. And I found that a good working definition for polyamory is the practice of having multiple romantic or sexual relationships at one, the same time with all partners' full knowledge and consent. And that part's really important, full knowledge and consent. Without that, you're just cheating, and we all know how we feel about that. But how does that work? I mean, society kind of views romantic love as a well, and you scrape the bottom of it, and that's it, that's all your love. But I'm actually going to quote Romeo and Juliet here. She says to Romeo, "My love is as boundless as the sea. The more I give to thee, the more I have." And that's how love works. It's a positive feedback cycle. The more you give, the more you have to give. The more you receive, the more you want to give. And as a society, we're fine with that notion as long as we're talking about platonic or familial love. We understand that you get a new brother or sister and you're not like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I have enough siblings already. I can't love you." You get a new friend. "Oh, sorry, one of the other friends has to go. Bye." But romantic love, you're supposed to find your one person, and if you fall in love or in lust with anybody else, something must be wrong with you, or you're not in the right relationship. And polyamory takes that possessive notion of love, that one person is yours and yours alone, and says, "Nah, we can do better than that. Some of us want to." And so once you understand what polyamory is, let's move on to what is emotional literacy. And emotional literacy is the ability to understand and communicate about emotions, both your own and others. And that really starts within oneself. You build emotional literacy by understanding your own emotions. You say, "I'm feeling jealous. Why? I'm happy. Why am I happy?" And you get into the deep roots of your own emotions and take a walk down the scary road of your own psyche. And as you do that, you begin to talk with somebody and you find out that fights that you may have had that are getting worse and worse and worse, the more you communicate about your own emotions. "I'm sorry, I'm feeling jealous because you talk more to this guy than you talk to me." Once you start to do that, people reciprocate. They start to talk about their own emotions, and it creates another positive feedback loop. And polyamory is really good at building emotional literacy because there is no normal in polyamorous relationships. Each time, you have to sit down with your partners and say, "What do we want out of our relationships? Do we want to have sex? Do we not? Are we polyfidelis? Are we only dating people within our group?" And that requires a lot of emotional literacy and the willingness to deal with it and say, "This is what I want and this is what I'm willing to compromise on." So polyamorous groups are really good at that. They talk about emotions, they deal with emotions, and they help the newbies understand what's going on with them. But what benefit does that bring to society as a whole? Well, obviously, more emotionally literate you are, the better you all are able to handle people being different. As somebody that falls under the bisexual umbrella, the polyamorous community is the most accepting of that. You like girls, it's great. You like guys, it's great. You like them both, even better. Let's have a party. They're more accepting of people being a different gender, of being transitioning. Any kind of difference is more acceptable in the polyamorous community because we're already so far out there. There is no normal as long as you are not hurting anybody. So when society understands that monogamy is not the only way to have a relationship, that is perfectly acceptable and healthy to have polyamorous relationships, what does that do? Well, let me stop right here and say we're not going to convert everybody to polyamory. Some people are monogamous, some people are polyamorous, and then there's a spectrum in between, and that is all perfectly okay. But what happens is that now we have to confront the idea that we have, that we've been socialized to have, that you're going to grow up, you're going to find your one person, have a good wedding, and live happily ever after. Isn't that the formula? You know, grow up, get married, have kids. Hopefully have a job in there somewhere. But when we can accept that that's not the only way to do things, we have to look in with ourselves. We have to say, even if we are monogamous, we have to look at, make sure that that's what we want and that's the only thing we want. And when we do that, we build our own emotional literacy. And a more emotionally literate society is better able to handle crises as a whole. We might actually get something done in politics if we can, you know, talk about things in a reasonable manner as opposed to doing terrible, terrible things to each other. So what I want to leave you with is this idea that love is not finite. It is infinite in all its many forms, and almost all of them are beautiful. And so build your own emotional literacy. Think about why you're feeling what you're feeling.
Perhaps what matters most is not whether someone chooses monogamy or polyamory, but whether we understand ourselves honestly enough to love responsibly. Because beneath labels, beneath ideologies, beneath trends, human longing remains surprisingly ancient. We want to belong, to be chosen, to feel safe, to feel desired, to feel known. And perhaps attachment theory reminds us of something tender, that many adults are still quietly carrying younger versions of themselves into relationships. Children who feared abandonment, teenagers who confused intensity with love, adults still learning how to trust, still learning how to stay, still learning how to speak difficult truths before silence grows too loud. Maybe intimacy is not something we find. Maybe intimacy is something we practice. Messily, imperfectly, repeatedly. And maybe the bravest thing in love is not falling, but remaining emotionally awake, even after disappointment, even after fear, even after heartbreak.
You can be me, and I'll drink all the time.
If today's journey reminded us of anything, perhaps it is this. Love is never only romance. It is memory, attachment, fear, hope, biology, choice. And perhaps what we call intimacy is simply the lifelong work of learning how to meet another human being without disappearing from ourselves. Thank you for being with us wherever in the world you listened today. This was Infantly Curious on The Voice of Greece. I'm Katerina Badzaiki, on sound Nick Savorginakis. Until next Sunday, stay curious and perhaps stay brave enough to love.